Shall we turn in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 41? Genesis chapter 41, and remember our subject. It's Joseph in exaltation. Beginning at verse 1, and it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river. And behold, there came up out of the river 7 well-favored cows, and fat-fleshed, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ill-favored and lean-fleshed, and stood by the other cows upon the brink of the river. And the ill-favored and lean-fleshed cows did eat up the 7 well-favored and fat cows, so Pharaoh awoke. And he slept and dreamed the second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain come up out of one stalk, full and good. And behold, 7 thin ears, blighted with the east wind, sprung up after them. The 7 thin ears devoured the 7 fat and full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all of the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. Then spoke the chief butler unto Pharaoh, saying, I do remember my faults this day. Pharaoh was angry with his servants, and he put me in prison in the captain of the guard's house, both me and the chief baker. And we dreamed a dream in one night, I and he. We dreamed each man according to the interpretation of his dream. And there was there with us a young man, a Hebrew, a servant to the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted to us our dreams, to each man according to his dream he did interpret. And it came to pass, as he interpreted to us, so it was. Me he restored unto mine office, and him he hanged. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself and changed his raiment, and came in unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of thee that thou canst interpret a dream, thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. And we find Joseph interpreting the dreams. And shall we now go on down to verse 36, 37. And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh, and in the eyes of all of his servants. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, can we find such a one as this is? A man in whom the Spirit of God is? And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, forasmuch as God has shown thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen. and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried before him, bow the knee. And he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Just two more verses. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him as his wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt, and Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. May the Lord, by His Spirit, richly bless this portion to our hearts. And may the Spirit of God so move in our hearts that we will be moved as He will use whomsoever He will. And brethren, if I ignore any of you, be a little bit more deliberate with your hand when you hold it up. I don't want to pass by anybody, and I do want the Spirit of God to move and to show us the things of Christ and to glorify Him. Our brother Tom this morning will open up the portion, followed by, of course, our brother John, and then there will be the liberty for us all.
Well, we've been studying in the life of Joseph, and we've studied about his boyhood and the events that led him to Egypt. And then yesterday we talked about the events that befell him in Egypt in the house of Potiphar and in the prison. We've been noting the ways in which he is representative of the Lord Jesus. We've been trying to note some of the ways in which God's providence is seen in these things so that we may learn to trust Him the more in His dealing with us. And we've been trying to observe practical things, too, that we can take and use when we get back to wherever we happen to go when we go from here, or maybe even can use here, whatever we're doing here, the things that will direct us and bless us. Now, this chapter is a very full one. I divide it into three sections, for better or for worse. I'm not like McLaren, the Scottish preacher. They said he had a magic hammer, and he could tap any verse in the Bible, and it immediately fell into three equally uniform sections. But for sake of discussion, this chapter easily falls into three sections, verses 1 through 14, where the problem is found, and verses 15 through 36, where the general understanding of it is given, and then verses 37 to the end, where the solution of it is presented. Now, those are not ironclad, but they just help me to keep a flow of thinking for the particular circumstance, both in Joseph's life and how things went in the court of Egypt. Because this is a dramatic chapter, and you see a change in the life of Joseph, which from one moment to the next, practically speaking, he's at the bottom of things at the start and right at the top of things at the end. It is a dramatic, dramatic chapter, and there are many evidences of God's dealing and many lessons for us, too. 2 years passed between the previous chapter and this one, and as Brother Phillips mentioned yesterday, they must have been long years for Joseph. There's never any indication that he sat in prison and scratched them off on the wall like we might on a calendar today, but they must have been long years for him. He certainly had every reason to expect that the butler would remember him, but we are told in the end of the last chapter that the butler forgot him. He was glad to be back handing the cup to Pharaoh. The position of butler was one of the most important in the house of the ancient kings. We certainly know that it was in Babylonia and Assyria, and we assume that that was true in Egypt also. He brought the king his portion. And if there was anything wrong with the portion, I mean, the butler was the last man to touch it before it got to the king, and consequently, he was the most important man to the king's safety, even including his own bodyguard. If a butler didn't like the king and had nerve enough to kill himself, he could kill them both with one meal, so to speak. So his was a very important position. Consequently, any time the king was in trouble, oftentimes the butler or the wine steward was in trouble too. Just one of those circumstances. So when we come to this chapter, we find that for 2 years the butler has been back in his position. And then Pharaoh is given this amazing dream, which Joseph will later say it's not two dreams, it's just one dream. The cows and the corn are all the same thing, he will say. It's just one dream, but it's such an important one, heavy one, that God shows it to Pharaoh twice. The amazing providence of God in this dream is that the magicians could not interpret it, believe it or not. See, in Egypt, two things had to be done, at least. One was they had to interpret it, but two, the interpretation was it had to please Pharaoh. You'll remember that years later, Nebuchadnezzar will say to his magicians, they'll say to him, they'll say, tell us the dream and we'll interpret it. And Nebuchadnezzar will say, sure, I know that. If I tell you the dream, you'll have an interpretation for it. And you can do that too. You can interpret anybody's dream. And when knowing the magicians in Egypt, the connivers that they were, the amazing thing was that they did not have an interpretation for it. Not that they didn't know the truth. That was inconsequential. But like modern astrologers, that they didn't have an interpretation. If they gave him one that displeased him, there would have been new magicians in court the next day. That they had nothing to say is an amazing example of the providence of God, although it's a kind of a small point that we easily miss. He says there are 7 head cattle and 7 more cattle and 7 ears, and that some of the magicians didn't have something to say of a mystical sort is an amazing thing. But it mystified them, and they were afraid to speak. And so it is that under that circumstance, he wonders who can interpret, and the butler remembers Joseph. Now, Joseph comes into Pharaoh's presence in verse 14, shaved and in a clean garment. He'd been in prison all those years. He had a good position in prison, but a good position in prison is still prison. It's one of those things. So we can't say too much about him, I don't think, in detail there. But the Egyptians, as I mentioned, were clean-shaven. That was one of the glories of Egypt. They were prone to think that to have a lot of hair on your head or on your face was a bad sign. They tended to be clean-shaven. And consequently, their prisoners were often disgraced by wearing beards that the prison guards pulled out when they got irritated. But Joseph comes into Pharaoh's presence in new clothes and cleanly shaven, which is just an incidental note that if you're going to appear, I didn't wear my tie this morning, but if you're going to appear before a good company, it's good to look well at the time. But whatever the case is, he's in Pharaoh's presence. Pharaoh tells him the dream. Joseph does not presume that he has the capacity to do these things. We're told in verse 16 something that's consistent with the whole picture of Joseph. He doesn't say to Pharaoh, I'll tell you. He says, rather, God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace, meaning God will give Pharaoh an answer that satisfies him. As in the case of the men in prison, so with Pharaoh, Joseph's life is consistent. He looks to God and expects the help and honor that God will both give and that God needs. It's consistent with his character all through this particular thing. And then Pharaoh tells him the dream, and Joseph tells him in verse 25 that God has shown him what he's about to do. He reemphasizes that the dream is not two, but one, so that Pharaoh will pay particular attention to it. And then in verse 32, he says, the thing is established by God, who will shortly bring it to pass. Now, verse 32 is a remarkable sort of a small example with regard to God's control of history and governments, and also the fulfillment of predictions. It's just one of those little insight-type things. But back in Genesis 15, the Lord said to Abraham, he said, your seed will go to a land not their own, and they will be there for 400 years. He predicted that to Abraham when he discussed the covenant in Genesis 15. And then he said, when their time is up, and incidentally, when the iniquity of the Amorites in Canaan is brought to its fullness, he says, I will bring them out with a strong hand. I'll bring them out rich, he said, after they've been evil treated, and they'll have the land I promised to you. Now, when Joseph says this thing is prepared or established by God, maybe it isn't the first step, but it is one of the early steps in God's fulfillment of that prediction to Abraham, namely getting them down to that land. He will bring them out somewhat later. But things were maybe not perfect in Canaan, but Jacob was prospering and his tribes were prospering and his cattle and all that in Canaan. So Joseph, again, I don't know how much he knew in detail, but he knew that God had prepared a situation of which there would be 7 good years followed by 7 bad years, and how many other things he knew, I'm not sure of. But those 7 good years, 7 bad year sequence, with Joseph in the place of premiership, would be the means of getting the Israelites down to Egypt for the fulfillment of that promise, then the eventual punishment of the Amorites and the bringing them back to God's glory into the land that really belonged to them. So he says to Pharaoh, he says, that's the way it is, and then he tells Pharaoh what he ought to do. Again, he doesn't suggest himself. He thinks it would be good if Pharaoh found a man who would handle these things. And then Pharaoh, because the dream interpretation did satisfy his heart, he looks out and says, is there anybody like you? In effect, that's what he says. And the answer is not an audible one, but there obviously isn't. And so Joseph is promoted to that position. Now, the next few verses where we have the solution to this problem cover a couple of years. From his promotion to that position down through the birth of his first 2 sons, they cover roughly the good years, the 7 good years, and move towards the 7 bad years. And there are a lot of rich things to be shared there. I will merely note, see, that he's given a position second only to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh gives him this rather remarkable name that the scholars are not sure how to interpret exactly. I have a friend who's an authority on ancient Coptic. There are only about 7 of them in the whole world. They're a dying breed. He said to me, he said, in our old Coptic text, the name Zaphnath-Paaneth would mean God reveals the secrets. In the older Egyptian language, the older whatever they call that right now, when you get to be my age, your memory slips. Whatever they call that, the more literal interpretation would be God lives and speaks. But as one of my colleagues said, and as Mr. Phillips suggested to us the other day, regardless of what the literal meaning might be, the action is this. Whenever the name is sounded, people bow the knee before Joseph. That name brings the Egyptians and all others in the land to their knees, because there comes the man who is second only to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I'm Pharaoh, and not one thing will be done in this land except you say so. That name brings the nation to their knees. It's a remarkable way in which Joseph is elevated and blessed in the providence of God, and God's control and work through it is pretty emphatic. So I think that's all I will say, Brother Charles.
Well, I think that's rather thorough.
Well, there's tons of stuff here.
But I believe that our Brother John will have something for us.
Wasn't it Solomon who said, what shall the man say who cometh after the king? Well, I thought it might be interesting to give you a little picture of the position to which Joseph was elevated by Pharaoh. It was a well-known position in the land of Egypt. He was appointed to be the grand vizier of Egypt. I suppose it would be the equivalent to a prime minister, except that his powers were derived not from the people, but directly from the throne. He was the chief officer of state under Pharaoh. The office entailed carrying on all the administrative functions of the kingdom of Egypt, apart from the religious side of things. It was his duty to appoint 4 reporters who 3 times a year were responsible for a statement of affairs in the provinces. He received reports from the district inspectors. He attended to the provincial boundaries, the allocation of land, orders for second crops, supervised the matters connected with the inundation of the Nile, was responsible for tax arrears. Robberies in the province were investigated by him, the complaints of local governors. And under him there were many other officials with high-sounding titles. There was the fan-bearer of the king's right hand. There was a man known as the eyes and ears of the king, who made official inquiries into matters drawn to the attention of the throne. There was the messenger in the country, the tutor responsible for the education of the royal children, the scribe of Horus, the chief of the guard, who I suppose would be Potiphar. And these and many other officials of high rank reported to the Grand Vizier. His Majesty's envoys and vice regents in far-off lands would be well known to this man. In fact, the tombs depict scenes of this official receiving gifts from countries beyond the seas. The entire system of Egyptian law and order was the responsibility of the Grand Vizier of Egypt. His task was to uphold the strong, centralized, authoritarian, absolute power of the Pharaoh, so that his divine majesty could carry on those public works and erect those monuments which would awe people not only in his day, but for the rest of time. It was his job to uphold the rigid bureaucratic control of the country, so that ultimately all power through him might come to rest in the person of the Pharaoh. His job was to visit the great cities of Egypt, the vassal states, and the provinces, and local officials would automatically prostrate themselves before him. Scribes would dance attendance upon him everywhere he went. He would ask probing questions up and down the Nile regarding the next inundation. Was it to be a good Nile or a bad Nile? In what state of repair are the dikes? How much forced labor would need to be impressed to keep the dikes and the canals in good repair? What is the expected agricultural yield from this area? What are the states of the herds and the cattle? Let me have a look at the census lists. Are these lists accurate? It was one of his jobs to keep a constant check on local princelings in his inspection tours so that they were not allowed to get too strong. And he appointed district inspectors to keep an eye on provincial governors. As he traveled from place to place, it was the custom of the Grand Vizier of Egypt not even to notice the laborers driving their teams of oxen, bending their backs, widening the irrigation canals, working in the hot sun, the backbone of Egypt, and yet counting for nothing. As he walks along the quay or inspects some mighty monument going up to the glory of the Pharaoh, he would be preceded by his guards and by his staff, who would clear away from him, from before him, and the people all around would automatically bow themselves to the ground and bury their faces in the dust. He would drive a golden chariot, preceded by runners, and he would live in a magnificent mansion in the suburbs. This was the position to which Pharaoh exalted Joseph. It was the highest position in Egypt, and incidentally it was one which from antiquity was notable for its graft and its corruption. You just imagine a man with all these people fawning upon him would find ample opportunity to line his purse. I was talking to Brother Tom a few minutes ago, and he was suggesting that perhaps this is one reason why Joseph was able to keep the position for 80 years. They'd never had a man who was incorruptible in that position. Mm-hmm. And so this was the position to which, in the counsels and purposes and will of God, Joseph was to be erected and raised. It was the highest possible position. He had all the powers of a king vested in him. I was interested in looking at this chapter to give some thought to the providential ways of God, and to the perfect wisdom of God, and to the peerless will of God as it's exhibited in this chapter. I was particularly impressed by the perfect timings of God in connection with the exaltation of Joseph. Those long years in prison must have seemed a terrible, endless time to Joseph. They were just a watch in the night to God. They were nothing. Just a few short years out of a lifetime. God was waiting for the time to be ripe, as he waited 400 years for the iniquity of the Amorites to be full. He waited until Pharaoh was ready. He waited until Joseph was ready. He waited until even the butler was ready. The butler wouldn't be too anxious to remind Pharaoh that he'd been in prison. But after this lapse of time, even the butler would be ready to say his piece. I think there would be a tremendous service done to the Christian church if somebody with the pen of a ready writer and with a sufficient scholarship could write a book on the timings of God in human history. It would be one of the most fascinating books ever written. The timings of God. You could begin with the Bible. But what a book it would be. And here we have an exhibit of the perfect timing of God in a human life. Not too soon, not too late, but just at the exact time when the time was right, God acted. We so often spoil things by being in a hurry. The great example, of course, is Abraham marrying Hagar, trying to hurry things up. But in the providence of God, you see his perfect timings. You also see his perfect tactics in this chapter. And I'm impressed, granted, of course, the supernatural nature of the dreams that came to Pharaoh. Yet how naturally it all happens, doesn't it? There are no miracles in connection with this. It's just a simply natural outworking of ordinary events. The fellow has a dream. In fact, he has two of them. They bother him. He can't sleep. He asks them questions. And through a natural process of asking questions, he's led to Joseph, and Joseph's brought in, and he's put to the throne. It's just a series of events that could happen in anybody's life. And this reminds me that God very rarely acts in miracles. As such, you know, supernatural, spectacular, earth-shaking miracles. There are only four periods of such miracles in the Bible. There is the period in connection with Moses, the emancipating miracles that shook Egypt to its foundations and led to the emancipation of the children of Israel and those miraculous provisions across the wilderness. That was one period of miracles in divine history. There were the educational miracles that took place in the days of Elijah and Elisha, intended to bring Israel back to God. There were the evidential miracles that took place during the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ and the early church. And of course there are those what we could call the eschatological miracles that are to take place in connection with the end of the age. The coming age is to be an age of miracles, battle of miracles. The miracles of the devil through the two beasts and the miracles of the two prophets. It's going to be an age of miracles. But there are only these four periods in Bible history where you have a remarkable outbreak of the miraculous. God doesn't found things upon miracles. And it's impressive to me, anyway, that the natural, simple, easy outworking of the mind and will of God in this connection here, the dream and the interpretation and the exaltation of Joseph to the right hand of the majesty of the Pharaoh. I've been thinking, too, in connection with Joseph appearing before Pharaoh, a man who was supposed to be God. He was supposed to be the incarnation of Ra, and whose functions were very largely religious, a priest-king, intended to be a mediator between the people and the unseen powers, who was supposed to embody in himself the virility of the nation, whose whole life was surrounded by ritual and symbolism, whose every hour was allocated to duties mostly of a religious nature. And here Joseph appears before this king. And you can just imagine what the devil's whispering in his ear. He's saying, now don't blow it, man. This is your great chance. Don't you be preacher to this stuff. And the very first thing Joseph does, he preaches Pharaoh a little sermon. He says, it's not in me. He says, God. And he immediately puts matters in their proper perspective, and he bears his witness and his testimony to Pharaoh, to the living God. That's just a beautiful touch in the life of Joseph, so typical of Joseph. God, he says, shall give Pharaoh an answer to peace. And then, as if he's not content with giving a testimony to God, he proceeds to give Pharaoh a lecture on economics and sound business administration. It's no wonder that Pharaoh was attracted to Joseph and immediately promoted him to this position. There's lots more, as we have hinted, that could be said. Perhaps somebody's going to tell us something about Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On. She must have been a very interesting person in her own right. And certainly she's a typical person.
I'd like to say to those who came in late, we are just trying to gather together in family character, and we'd appreciate if you would just come up a little further front. There are plenty of seats. We wrote it off so nobody would fit in the back. Would you be free? Oh. While our brethren are getting ready to hold up their hands, I was thinking of this this morning. We've been studying about the trials in the lives of God's people. And I don't believe that we can spend any amount of time in studying these things, but what trials are going to come upon us. And before maybe we get too far away from the conference grounds, there may be some trials that come upon us. And how are we going to face them? We've seen that there's two ways. There's the human side of it and then the divine side. If Joseph would have just looked at the human side, he would have spoken certainly of Potiphar and his severity and his meanness in putting him in prison. And then he would have said, that ungrateful wretch that wouldn't remember me when he got free. And when we murmur and complain like that, it weakens us, it spoils our testimony, and it weakens us for the next trial. But if, like Joseph, we look at it at the divine side and say, God is working, the Lord is near, and these things are just happening in my life, that the character and the virtues of Christ might be developed in me. Brother McNeil, not O'Neill.
That's an interesting point, because we're often confronted with the question, are the heathen lost, and the unfairness of God in not revealing himself to the pagan people. But I remember reading in Dan Crawford's book, Thinking Black, some years ago, an incident that he relates in the early days of pioneer work in Africa. He was journeying across a tract of territory, and his path intersected that of a group of black Africans who were an embassy. They were going from one chief to another chief. And Dan Crawford relates the fact that he got into conversation with these men. He discovered that God had revealed himself to their chief in a dream. And he was astonished at the completeness of the revelation that God had given to this chief in a dream. And so greatly was this particular chief impressed by the dream that he had received in the night from the Great Spirit, that he was actually sending a dream embassy. He was actually sending ambassadors from his court to a brother king to communicate to him the truth that had been revealed in a dream in his own court. And Dan Crawford comments on this. He said, picture me a missionary. Learning from these pagan people truth that I thought was only in the Bible. And he adds this succulent comment at the end. He said, I came to the conclusion that God can still speak to those to whom he doesn't write.
Doesn't the apostle who wrote Hebrews substantiate this thought too, that in past days God spoke in many ways to us? But how blessed it is at the end of the verse, but in these last days he has spoken unto us by and through his Son. I saw a hand over to the left. Please, is there a question or a thought? Wilson Baker. Another hand? If not, I have the authority, you know, to speak to one on my left and one on my right. This is a blessed place to be in, you know. It's an exalted place I have. Brother Roger.
I think it was no doubt very educational for him. And I think it's interesting that the Potiphar first and the keeper of the prison later recognized in Joseph superior skills to their own. And he certainly got a real education in Potiphar's house in management and probably in getting along with people in prison. So certainly I think that he developed himself in those areas very, very much. And certainly the knowledge that he acquired helped him tremendously when he came to Pharaoh's throne. Brother Phillips yesterday mentioned his industry. And you can't help but believe that all the time he was in prison in Potiphar's house too, he was learning. And he probably knew as much about Egypt when he came before Pharaoh as anybody around. No chapter and verse on that, but just knowing the industry of Joseph, he likely did.
Think that over a little, Brother Tom.
Well, there might well be. I'm not really gifted in those areas, and I plead a certain amount of ignorance, but there might well be. No? No, I'm claiming that there's a lot of things but don't know. I'm usually glad to tell whatever I do know. but there may well be. They certainly are significant numbers. And the fact that Joseph dreamed of 12 when we're not really sure that Benjamin was born yet, although that, again, is an arguable thing, is certainly a striking thing. But I don't really know. Brother Phillips might have a more intelligent comment. I wouldn't doubt what there is some symbolism that's real.
I'll repeat the question, if I can. There are 12 dreams connected with...
12. He dreams of 12.
He dreams of 12.
Brethren.
And when you come to the New Testament...
He's working on a pattern of 12 and 7.
12 and 7. Which would speak of administration and completeness. Brother McNeil, what could you put on the three? We'll discuss that under the trees more fully.
He is really a very good example to us of a willing and yielded spirit to God, who, when God does bring things to pass in time, will then act on it without recrimination or regret. And whereas Abraham rushed God's time, humanly speaking, a few years later, Barak would stall off God's time. And when the time would come, Barak would say, well, it sure isn't time yet, in effect. So that you run between two groups when it comes to the time to do things, those who can't wait, sometimes for what, humanly speaking, might seem good reasons, but those who can't wait, and those who can wait forever. Joseph is really a wonderful example in this line of a man who can patiently trust God for his dealings, but when he's brought to the court, he knows what to say, and he speaks. And he doesn't do like some of us might have done and say, well, I really am not good at this sort of thing at all. He's a very good example of that, of course, in the providence of God.
That's a very good point, but what was our brethren was seeking to bring before us, where there was no revelation, God, no written revelation, God would reveal himself in dreams. But today it is true, very definitely true, to those who have written revelation, God reveals himself to us, I'm sure, in the person of Christ. But it isn't it a marvelous thing to hear of these men in heathen lands whom God has spoken to even today in dreams, due to not having a written revelation. Brother Scott.
No. The whole period of Egyptian history from about 2000 A.D. to 1570 is badly obscured by the Hyksos Age, which took over about 1750. And that whole segment, hardly a thing is known. Now, the nature of the office that Mr. Phillips described somewhat earlier, that's an historic office in Egypt, both before and after the Hyksos Age, and there's tons of material about the man who would hold that office. But during this whole period, very little remains to us. The Hyksos Age will come in about 1750. Joseph probably contributed indirectly to that by bringing the Israelites down and others too. And that is a great blur in Egyptian history where no monuments were left, no written fragments were left, hardly at all. Just a few scattered curses on Canaanite peoples and a few inscriptions telling how evil they were. So that total period. But in all the ages before that and after that, only one or two great men beside Pharaoh are mentioned. The Pharaohs did not mention of their own free will anybody but themselves. And Thutmose, years later, will take all the great monuments that the Queen Mother built and cut her name off of them and put his on, so that she, who was one of the most famous rulers in all Egypt, would be completely lost to us for generations and generations. Years later, Ramses II would try to do the same thing to Thutmose. So that we say humorously, he was the great chiseler of all time. So that in the Egyptian histories, there are just many, many men known to us from Babylonian records, known to us from Assyrian records, known even later, but are not known in Egyptian records. The pharaohs like to talk a lot about themselves. They were very good at that, and not much good at talking about others. Joseph probably lived through the reigns of three or four pharaohs. But as I say, that whole dynastic period is not clearly known. A managed press, that's right. The pharaohs had it beautifully.
Brother Roger. Tom says give that one to John.
I just say amen.
Good. Right, Shirley, Howard, Brother Howard. Well, our time has ended for today, and I think it has been very profitable. And I marvel how that we can, with a large group like this, open the portion up and allowing, permitting, without grieving, the Spirit of God to move and use whomsoever He will. My, what a place of blessing we're found in. May the Spirit of God continue throughout the week to move in our hearts and to take the things of our Lord Jesus, the one through whom every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that He's Lord. Take the things of Him and show them unto us. In closing, I'm going to ask Brother Glock from Baltimore to close with a word.